From the independent producer project of KCRW, this is Here Be Monsters.
Hey, how are ya?
I'm well, how are you?
I'm great. Well, I made those phone calls I told you I was going to make to those men. To tell them that I am not dying anymore.
You're actually closer to death now than you were then.
Isn't it funny? Yeah, I am. But further from death than I told them I was.
Whenever I tell my therapist about the things I regret doing as a kid, she tells me to start mentioning them in everyday conversation, like they're no big deal. At a bar, to a friend, to a stranger, whatever. She says as long as I'm talking about my regrets casually, they'll stop feeling like doomsday secrets eroding in my stomach. But that's much harder than it sounds. I don't really know how to say, oh, hey, I stole $20 from your mom when we were kids, like it's no big deal. And I did do that. But it's not the worst thing I did. I used to tell people that I was dying. It started when I was 15. It was always men I was attracted to or thought I had a chance with. It's the kind of lie that seems completely detached from how I behave now. But for the last decade, I've lived with enormous guilt. I've wondered, was that specific lie big enough to make me psychotic? Did everyone know I was making it up? Do some of those men think that I'm dead? Is it possible to be a good person now if I did such a bad thing then?
Here Be Monsters, the podcast about... the podcast about...
the unknown.
Hello?
There was a guy I used to work with in high school. It was an Italian restaurant, and we worked in the cramped back room together boxing up takeout orders. I haven't spoken to him in almost 8 years.
Okay, so do you remember when we worked together and I told you that I was sick with, something respiratory related and I would cough a whole lot?
Vaguely.
I made that whole thing up. And I told that lie to a few people, and I've been feeling, like, terrible about it for the last 12 years, and I just wanted to tell you that I'm sorry, and
that's
that
okay.
I made it up.
I mean, I remember you telling me that you had maybe a disease or whatever, and that you were not going to live to 30. But, I mean, it is what it is, you know. If you feel bad about it, I guess you get it off your chest.
Do you feel like you knew at the time that I was making it up?
Maybe. I'm not saying that you're a liar or whatever, but that doesn't surprise me, you know, that there would be a story or something.
If you could tell that I was telling stories, why did you still like me? Like, why did you still want to be my friend?
I don't know. I could pinpoint that on why or whatever. But obviously, I mean, we hung out with your friends or whatever. So, I mean, I don't know. That's probably just like, that's who you are. You know? That's just who you are.
You
The first time I noticed a dying girl get the guy was when I watched Moulin Rouge. It was 2001, I was 13 years old. The movie celebrates 20th century pop music, the power of seduction, and drugs. It follows the story of Christian, a down-and-out poet. Christian finds a muse and a love interest in Satine, who is played by Nicole Kidman.
Tell a story, Christian. Promise me.
But little does he know, Satine is dying of tuberculosis. At the end of the film, Christian finally holds Satine in his arms, literally singing to her that he will love her until his dying day, and then she goes and dies. I adored Moulin Rouge. I bought the CD and I memorized every lyric. I took the lipsticks my mom got free with her purchases of age-erasing face creams and I painted them on my lips so that I, too, might look like a combination cabaret dancer and courtesan. This was seventh grade, my first year at Longfellow Middle School. Everything that happened that first year was textbook predictable. I ate lunch at a table by myself. I asked teachers for extra credit projects, even though I was getting all A's. I cried at home that no one liked me, and I wrote in my diary about how, at this rate, I'd never have a boyfriend. At the advice of Teen Vogue magazine, I told three classmates that I had a crush on some boy in the hopes that it'd get back to him in time for the school dance. It did get back to him, but he didn't ask me to the dance. Instead, he asked a blonde girl named Daisy, who told him no. Two years later, A Walk to Remember came out in theaters. Like Moulin Rouge, A Walk to Remember was about a dying girl whose boyfriend lived to tell the tale of her death, their love, and the lessons he learned. It was my new favorite movie.
I'm sick.
I'll take you home. You'll be better tomorrow.
No, Landon. I'm sick. I have leukemia.
No. You're 18. You're perfect.
No. I found out 2 years ago I've stopped responding to treatments.
Are you scared?
To death?
After he finds out about her cancer, Landon puts a lot of energy into his love for Jamie. He gives her her first kiss, he registers an actual star in outer space in her name. He marries her in the church where her parents got married, and in the scenes where she was dying, a radio in the background played songs by the pop star Mandy Moore, which was really weird because Mandy Moore was cast in the role of Jamie. Still, I was hooked.
I'm scared of not being with you.
Oh, baby, that'll never happen.
Okay.
There are tons of movies about dying women and the men who discover something about themselves after falling in love with them. In the time that Moulin Rouge and A Walk to Remember came out alone, there was also Sweet November, Autumn in New York, and Here on Earth, all telling more or less the same story. So, in my first couple years of high school, I told a handful of men that I'd be dead by the time I turned 30. Sometimes it was leukemia, sometimes it was a rare respiratory disease based loosely on Satine's tuberculosis in Moulin Rouge. But either way, I had 15 years of life left and the clock was ticking. My high school crush was 2 years older than me, a senior when I was a sophomore. He was brilliant and he was good looking, and what's more, he had a car. We used to drive around the Virginia suburbs together, eating shitty diner food and talking about the movies we liked. And then one day, he completely stopped talking to me.
Hello, this is...
Hey, it's Lena. I've been dreading this call because I feel very uncomfortable, but I think you can handle it, and I think so can I.
I don't know about that. I can't handle much.
Well, you're gonna handle it. And I would like to say out loud to you that when we were teenagers, I lied to you about having cancer.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah, it definitely rings a bell, but I can't remember any specifics.
It blows my mind that he doesn't remember, because the day I told him I had cancer was the same day he stopped talking to me. He frowned, he told me he hoped I was okay, and then he dropped me off at my parents' house. He never took a call, he never answered an instant message again. He knew I was lying.
There was a day that we were laying in your bed and we were cuddling, and that had never happened to me before.
If you say so. I don't remember that. I don't know. It doesn't, back then, I don't remember this happening. I remember you confessing something to me and me being outrageously pissed off.
God damn that you don't remember. It's crazy. We were in your bedroom and you told me to pick a song, and I picked Ground Control to Major Tom. I picked that song because it was the longest song that you had on your computer, and I didn't want us to have to get up again.
No one spends that much time thinking about those things.
But I did. I did when I was 15.
I remember that day because it was the first time anyone had ever touched me that way. I didn't even know there was a word for it, spooning. I thought nothing would ever be good like that again, especially if it wasn't with this particular person. Not unless he fell in love with me. The kind of I'll-do-anything-for-you love I had seen in movies. So I told him I had cancer, leukemia, the same kind Mandy Moore had in A Walk to Remember. I expected him to sit straight up in bed and, I don't know, do something about it. I hoped he'd pull some sort of a make-a-wish move, take me on a trip, and surprise me at midnight with a registered star in outer space to call my own. He'd go through my bucket list with me, even though I hadn't even written it yet, and make sure all of my wildest dreams came true before my imminent death, even though I wasn't dying.
And so if I felt that we were being very open and driving around and going to diners and talking about important things to us, and then to find out that something is a lie that the whole time probably seemed very suspicious, it was still very hurtful, I recall.
Like, I don't know what my problem was, but I do remember lying to you about how hard it was to be me, with like thinking that that would make you want to be around me more, like thinking that would make you want to protect me or like care about me more than you already did.
Forgiven? But I don't see how you can care about this so far in the past. Everyone's horrible until the age of like 25 or so.
When I tell lies now, they're usually really small, like telling people I'm too busy to go out on nights when I don't have anything planned, or telling a coworker everything's fine when I actually know it's not. When I do lie, I'll often make a big scene of apologizing. I'll say, listen, there's something I need to tell you and it might make you mad. And on top of the confessing, I do a lot of apologizing. I ask, did I just offend you? Are we okay? Do you still like me? My mom tells me it makes me seem suspicious, but once I start apologizing, I don't stop.
I'm going to tell you what was wrong. That I had a respiratory disease, and that it was potentially terminal, and that I was going to get surgery for it, but that we didn't know whether or not I was going to be okay.
Interesting.
But none of that is ringing a bell.
The coughing blood thing kind of does.
This was a friend I grew close to later on in high school when I was 16. He had crushes on a few of my friends, and he'd call to confide in me about them. I fantasized about him calling those girls to talk about me, but I don't think he did.
Because I feel like I have this memory of seeing you and you coughing and like a feeling of concern.
No, you're right. I coughed in front of you a bunch. That was imaginary, and that was a lie that I told multiple people.
Interesting. So you were totally healthy, and you were just like, yeah, I had this thing that could kill me.
Yeah, well, okay, so no, I obviously wasn't totally healthy because I was lying to people about my potentially terminal illnesses. Something was definitely wrong.
My sickness wasn't tuberculosis or blood cancer, it was depression. Even saying it now makes me feel like an idiot. Like this totally preventable and very embarrassing thing was festering in parts of my body, something that only I knew about. I remember my eyelids resting so heavy on my face. In class, I'd sit down and the room would spin. Immediately, I'd fall asleep, usually beneath a hood. Teachers would wake me up, and with a sharp breath, I'd say, "Okay, I'm up." But seconds later, I'd fall back asleep. It was debilitating, and it was ugly. I felt like a puddle of mud. If anyone had asked how to make it better, I'd have said, "I want a reputation, and I don't care for what." I think I was susceptible to personalities like they were radio signals I could turn the knob on. Turn it to the left, and there was the Christian virgin. Be sweet, be slight, be upbeat, be a real cheerleader. Turn it again, and there was the sexy girl. Be curvy, be smoky eye, be miniskirt, be bouncy hair. Turn it, there was the girl next door, there was the head of class, the rebel. I wanted to be dying. My mom took me to see a social worker who gave me a test in three parts. It took hours. I had to answer basic math problems and find meaning in bursts of black paint. The answer, it was decided, was medication. I tried three or four different kinds. We called it anxiety, we called it ADD, we called it genetic. We called it lots and lots of things at home when it was just me and my parents. But I didn't call it anything at school. At school, I just said I was dying of a rare and obscure disease.
I know that one motive that I had was a person whose name I'm going to say, but then not say again.
Sure. If I'm not mistaken, she still has cystic fibrosis, because I don't think you can get rid of that.
There was this girl at school who really was dying. She had a disease called cystic fibrosis. She talked about it pretty openly, and her friends were incredibly supportive.
What I remember about her is that she was this, like, tall glass of water with long, long, long curly brown hair and, like, very pale skin and, like, just looked like a model. And in my memory, a bunch of dudes, like, always had crushes on her.
That sounds accurate. Oh, yes. Yes, Kat. She was stunningly beautiful.
And I also remember people holding her hand and, like, helping her up steps. I remember people, like, playing with her hair or, like, hugging her from behind. I just remember these little, like, moments of intimacy surrounding her that I really wanted to.
She and I had about, like, a one-second thing.
You guys kissed, I remember.
Yeah. And I remember you not liking it. Absolutely remember you not liking it.
Well, 100%. I saw you kissing a person who had a terminal illness and then decided that I, too, have a terminal illness. Like, I don't think there's any disconnection there. Okay, the other thing that I've been thinking about is the fact that in those 4 years, a bunch of romantic teenage movies came out that were about a man falling in love with a woman who was literally dying.
What was that Mandy Moore movie?
A Walk to Remember.
That's it. That's the one I remember. Yes.
It's like it hammers in this really bizarre idea that it's not enough that a man would love you because you're this, like, totally amazing, beautiful, like, $30 million fucking Hollywood actress. Like, there has to be something wrong with you for him to really go the extra step and build you the house.
And it's also a dude fantasy. It's, you know, you get to really take care of your woman kind of thing. And be like, you get to be there for her all the way. I totally, that's a male fantasy as well.
Was that ever your male fantasy?
Yeah, you want to believe that you're the best guy. You want to believe you're this great dude. And so yeah, absolutely.
It sort of makes me feel like if I had just told you that I had a crush on you instead of telling you that I had a rare respiratory disease, like, maybe I would have gone on a date with you.
You could have gone for it, Lena, that's all I'm saying.
That's like makes me blush. It's been like 12 years.
images that are trafficked and these ideas that are disseminated have an impact. They have an impact, and they are dateable and traceable like the rings on a tree.
When I told him what I've been talking to you about, it was just really amazing to have anyone acknowledge to me that that they were struggling with that very specific kind of desire. And he also told me that if I had just told him I had a crush on him, he would have gone out on a date with me. Like, it wasn't as complicated as I made it.
I'm 27 years old now, just 3 years from my imaginary deathbed. Calling these three guys and telling them the truth was not easy. It was something I put off for a really long time, imagining them crying or yelling or hanging up on me. Turns out they all said kind of the same thing. Don't worry so much about being bad. And I think what was actually wrong wasn't that I was bad. It wasn't me or my depression or the likability of the girls I pitted myself against. It was that I was trying to insert myself into someone else's story. I'm no longer mystified by my lie. I was tricked. Tricked into thinking that if there was something big and uniquely wrong with me, I would be easier to notice and select. To be lovable, I had to be rare or fleeting. What's funny is that there are plenty of things wrong with me. And as I age, I notice new flaws. The only difference is now I just say so, to myself and to other people. I always had the captive audience. I just wasn't saying the right words.
Lena Mesitsis produced this episode of Here Be Monsters. Her therapist, who you heard at the beginning and at the end, is Julia Wallace. I edited this piece. My name is Jeff Antman, and I had help from Bethany Denton and our KCRW editor, Nick White. Our website is hbmpodcast.com, where, right now, we have a couple pictures of Lena as a teenager. Lena in the ocean. Lena in a bus. Lena looking at a basket of fruit on the back of an old car. Again, we're at hbmpodcast.com. Music on this show came from The Black Spot and Sarocell. And a big thank you to Saladin Aljerf, who recently gave us a generous donation. Saladin listens to Here Be Monsters in Abu Dhabi. Where do you listen? Let us know on Twitter. We're at @HBMPodcast. Here Be Monsters is a part of the Independent Producer Project from KCRW. Thank you for listening. More episodes soon.